Yes, thanks to the organizers for inviting me here. It's been a fascinating event so far. I learned a lot, mostly from the practitioners. I think what is interesting for me is that we are now almost 25 years from the emergence of the global anti-money laundering regime, and we seem to have the same fundamental questions about the phenomenon as we had when it all began. What is money laundering? How do we understand it? How do we record it? I found your presentation very interesting. What's the relationship between money laundering and the predicate offences? What is anti-money laundering law for? And Peter Aldrich just theorized expertly about this. Why do we need money laundering law? Where is the harm? Is it, especially after Rada's presentation on politically exposed persons, you know, is it to protect the markets? Is it to achieve political stability in the developing world? Is it simply to deter crime? And these are important questions because I think they inform the legal responses on that and our assessment about the effectiveness, as you mentioned, but also the proportionality of the anti-money laundering law and the impact on fundamental rights. So I think that this is an area which is not as young anymore in terms of legislation. We have a proliferation of measures with huge impact on the individual, but yet we're still talking about this. And I'm interested to see that practitioners also have questions about how the system works as well. Now, that's by way of an introduction. When Clive Kange asked me to come here, I asked what he wanted me to speak on. I offered to talk about terrorist sanctions because it's very interesting for a lawyer. There's a lot of case law. I could just talk to you about Mr. Caddy for an hour and then I would leave. But he said, no, I don't want you to speak about terrorist sanctions. I want you to talk to us about the Fourth Money Laundering Directive. So what I will try to do in my 15 minutes is to give you an overview of the evolution of EU law on money laundering and more specifically on the preventive duties, the regulatory aspect of things, which I think complements nicely the other presentations. For a lawyer, this is not always an easy task because this part of anti-money laundering law doesn't really have much case law. This is a part of the law that involves regulatory compliance by the financial sector and related professionals. So you either do a job on the data and you look at how many suspicious transaction reports and so on, or you look at, you know, you speak to the professionals about how, what the challenges are to implement. What I'm going to do is to, first of all, explain how European standards, which obviously influence domestic law, are in turn influenced by global standards and why we have a global synergy in the development of what some scholars have called a global regime against money laundering. And secondly, to go through four main areas of evolution of European law, going from the first to the fourth directive, and see how these issues have been addressed, and whether to link to the conference title as well, we have had successes or failures, and what we can see for the future. So first of all, in the morning we have very interesting and important presentations about confiscation, about case law. These have all a very domestic flavor because obviously they're influenced by the specificities of domestic law. But I think that in terms of the preventive duties, what you have in the statute book and in the money laundering regulations cannot be understood without looking at the global level. If you look at the European Union, the EU directives which the United Kingdom has to implement really follow almost religiously the revisions of the FATF recommendations. Now, the FATF itself is a very interesting beast when you look at from the point of view of global governance and international law. First of all, it is a club, so you know that the membership is the rich world, the OECD countries, plus in the past years expanded to include strategically important jurisdictions, China, India, Russia moved from a blacklisting country to now holding the presidency of the FATF, and that tells a lot. I think that's a very interesting development, and countries, of course, in Latin America. And I think that the FATF is fascinating to study from a governance perspective because obviously it is a club, It produces recommendations, something that some of you may call soft law, others call informal law, but I would call it soft law with hard teeth, because via the various methods of compliance and of regionalism, the FATF has managed to really export these recommendations in a very strong way across the globe. And these are really technocratic standards. So if you see it from a rule of law perspective, what happens in the FATF is that you have a group of experts representing certain interests deciding almost behind closed doors. Recently, the FATF had a consultation, a more public consultation on the revision of the 2012 recommendations, but still it's behind closed doors, and then it's presented as the absolute truth. Everybody has to comply with it via a series of compliance mechanisms. What is also interesting about the FATF is that it doesn't have an infinite mandate. Its mandate is renewed either on a 5 or on a 10-year basis, and each time that the mandate is to be renewed, it has to find a new raison d'etre. So it started, I think, with money laundering, and the latest incarnation includes even the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, which I think is interesting, going back to why we need money laundering law for. Do we really need it to counter the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction? It is an interesting game. But so we have a body which is evolving, which is very influential, standards which are evolving over time, and we can discuss whether you think this is a good or a bad thing. You know, some of you may say it is a good thing because we adjust to the reality. Some of you may say, well, we don't know whether anything is any effective, but we keep on adding to the rules, in a sense, and creating quite a complexity also for those who have to implement these rules. So if we go to the European Union now, you know that the Commission tabled last year a proposal for a fourth money laundering directive. I started looking into this field when the first money laundering was in force as part of my PhD in the late 90s. I thank the organizers for making me revisit this field What is interesting, I think, if you look at, if you're a nerd like me and you look at the preambles to these instruments and to the justifications by the European institutions, you see that for every single of these directives, claims that one of the justifications for its adoption at EU level is to comply and implement, to comply with and implement the recommendations of the FATF. So in a sense, you can say that we have a process of policy laundering, you know, something that has been adopted by experts in a technocratic way, is then legitimized via the adoption of the EU democratic process, which then is implemented in member states, mostly via the parliamentary route. So all four directives are here to respond to the FATF recommendations and the revision. So we have the first money laundering directive in 1991, the FATF recommendations for the first time were out in 1990, and then they were revised in 1996. We had the second directive in 2001, then we had 9/11, we had the third one in 2005, and now after the 2012 FATF recommendations, we have a new directive, a new draft directive, the fourth one, which was tabled last year. Four areas, broad areas, which I'm going to mention, where we have seen quite interesting developments over time. In this context are the following. The first one concerns what is money laundering, and we have discussed this quite a lot in the context of domestic litigation. A key question, of course, in this context is also what constitutes a predicate offense of money laundering. In the United Kingdom, I think you hinted at in your presentation, because POCA is so wide, I think this issue has not been a very big issue because you can include anything and everything in a sense within the scope. That's why you claim it's a very wonderfully simple and effective legislation. In other EU countries and in EU law, the predicate offenses have grown over time. So while the 1991 directive talked about money laundering only from drug trafficking and left some discretion to member states to expand, then we went to 2001 and 2005 and we had a move from drug trafficking to organized crime and corruption, to serious crime. Terrorist finance was included, but I'm not going to say anything about it because it's the next session. And now the fourth money laundering directive, what we have, which is very interesting, of course, is the inclusion of tax conduct or so-called tax offenses. Now, this is very interesting I'm not an expert in taxation at all, but what I can tell you is that we have now at the European level very interesting discussions, because obviously this is something that is not harmonized at the EU level. Each of the member states has their own approaches as to what is criminalized in the context of taxation. There is no willingness from the EU, whatever UKIP is saying, to harmonize this. I think that's very close to the bone. And so it raises interesting questions also when we look at judicial cooperation in Europe, because then money laundering is, of course, one of the offenses, the verification of the dual criminality of which has been abolished in the context of European arrest warrants. So if you have the UK issuing a European arrest warrant on a money laundering ground to France, for example, then I think differences in how you criminalize tax evasion between the two countries may play a part. So we have interesting times. I think it will be very difficult for, this will be one of the difficult issues, I think, in negotiations and into how it's going to be implemented. So that's the first, so what is criminalized? The second question, of course, is the how question. And this, I don't have any real data to share with you, but it has to do with the obligations, mainly of the regulated professions, but also of the unregulated ones, and the duties that we have. And what has proven problematic over time is something that probably many people didn't guess that would be so problematic in the beginning, and it's not really the suspicious reporting obligation, which attracted huge attention in the beginning, but it's really the know your customer, and know your customer now is a very big challenge. And if you look at both the FATF and the EU law, there are many challenges involving simplified or enhanced due diligence. So how much should you know about your customer, and how much work should you do? And this is linked with the whole question of politically exposed persons, and how much should the regulated and the unregulated sector know about what's going on. What is interesting in the negotiations of the fourth money laundering directive is that the European Parliament proposed an amendment to the Council's draft, and the Parliament is requiring a public register of beneficial ownership, which is quite an interesting step. And I was reading a Law Society briefing paper which said that the Law Society will lobby against this because of privacy considerations. So we live in interesting times. There are issues of feasibility as well, and so on. So we have a very big debate about what we mean by due diligence and how it's going to be implemented. Another development in this context, of course, is the development concerning the so-called risk-based approach to reporting. And that is something that I found very interesting. And initially I was very, and I think by default, I was very suspicious of the FATF. But this is one of the issues that you think make the system works. It started perhaps by being over-prescriptive. The regulated sector was saying, we are asked to be doing too much. We're sending you too many transactions, especially in the United States. It's not effective for law enforcement authorities. We need to work in a more intelligent way. The answer to that is the emphasis on prevention on the basis of a risk-based approach, which means that the regulated and unregulated sector and money laundering must use their judgment when they deal with the AML duties. This makes a lot of sense in practice. But from a legal perspective, it's a nightmare. From the perspective of a legal certainty, and what the regulated sector is expected to do is really a nightmare. I don't know what I would advise if I was a money laundering reporting officer in an organization. What is the risk-based approach? And how can you have a defense that you're taking this seriously when you are required at the same time to exercise judgment? So I think this is a big issue, and this may be litigated. I haven't seen much so far, but maybe there have been things that I'm not aware of. The third development is the development of who will check. And we are focusing, of course, on banks and the financial sector. But as you know, over time, the web has expanded. And today I heard quite a lot, and I found very interesting, that it's not really the banks, it's really the real estate agents and the jewelers and the art dealers and so on. So this has expanded a lot. And it includes lawyers. And the inclusion of lawyers is very interesting because, unsurprisingly, if you want to start it from an academic perspective, it has led to litigation. So lawyers are saying, no, this is the end of the rule of law as we know it. We are not going to report anything to the authorities. We have There is legal privilege, there is, you know, confidentiality and so on. Here we have case law in Europe, so that's the only field, and perhaps unsurprisingly, because lawyers have challenged this. The only way for the EU to manage to agree to extend AML obligations to lawyers was to label it as a counter-terrorist measure after 9/11. The second Money-Laundering Directive was due to fail before 9/11, and then after 9/11, the European Parliament was pushed to a corner to agree, because if you don't agree, then you know you are a terrorist. So the compromise that was found is that lawyers are included within the preventive duties unless they are in a position where they give legal advice or they ascertain the legal position of their client. So that was the Solomon solution in the directive. It has been challenged both in the Court of Justice in Luxembourg and in the European Court of Human Rights. Both courts found that this obligation is fine. It does not it does not breach fundamental rights. What I found interesting in the Strasbourg ruling, a ruling called Michaud, which was a ruling that was out last year, I think, is that one of the arguments of the lawyer who brought the case in Strasbourg was that it is unnecessary to impose obligations to lawyers because you cannot prove that these obligations make the prevention of money laundering effective. So you cannot just say that, you know, I impose this on you and, you know, and that's enough. And the Court of Human Rights, in a very interesting, I think, aside in the ruling, said that you are wrong, because we have read the evaluation of France by the FATF, which is very interesting. The FATF is in the body of the judgment of the Court of Human Rights, and it says that France is a very effective framework. So, you know, you have no case. So you see how soft law and, you know, judge-made law is kind of interlinked in this context, and you know, this may not be the only time that this will happen. My last comment is something we have not discussed as much today, to my surprise. Where does all this data, this information end up? Where do suspicious transactions report end up? And they end up, according to EU law, to bodies called the financial intelligence units. Now, what, from a practical point of view, these are wonderful. We have a wonderful diversity in Europe of the type of financial intelligence unit. Different member states were left with a leeway to structure it as they wish. So we range from law enforcement model, which is the UK model, to models in other member states, which is either an administrative authority within the Ministry of Finance or a purely independent authority. A number of member states said that the fact that the bank sends a report on a transaction which is considered to be suspicious shouldn't mean anything for the individual involved. So, you know, there should be a filter which is outside the police sector. And then only if they establish the real suspicion should the criminal justice system be involved, which is so unlike the UK system, but it exists in the majority of the other EU member states. Now, the problem with the diversity of these approaches is that the EU directive, the third and the fourth one, say, call for maximum cooperation between FIUs. So they say that the nature of the FIU shouldn't really matter, that, you know, they should exchange information, and so on. I mean, this, I think, to me, is contrary to European privacy and data protection law. You cannot oblige, I think, an independent FIU to allow access to its database to a police authority from another member state. There is the principle of purpose limitation, and recent case law in Luxembourg on issues of data retention and data protection, including the case whereby the data retention directive was annulled, are very important for our purposes. And I think that increasingly courts find that the bulk collection of everyday personal data, which are not directly linked to the commission of a criminal offense, is increasingly against human rights. And I think, in my view, this would be the main challenge for the development of future AML law. Thank you.